Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Is everybody getting the website that I have up here that has my notes? I'm not sure if everybody can see them. Okay, good. What we're going to do is I'm going to start and go very slowly over these notes, very briefly. Not in the sense that I'm not going to cover, yes, that's right, the Brooklyn Telescope. Not because we're not going to cover all the information that is on here, but rather I'm not going to give the entire lectures, which are already recorded in periods of hours. But I know that some of you who are listening are new to this information, and we're going to start from here. The first lecture that we had was from Isa to Islam, a historical journey. And I gave this idea called the Broken Telescope. And I told the story, which I'm going to read in part, says, during the first part of 1997, a group of young adults walked into a specialty store and bought an expensive and powerful telescope to look at a comet that was not yet visible with the naked eye. A few days later, they returned the telescope and asked for their money back because the telescope is broken. When asked how it was broken, the group said that the telescope did not show the spaceship that was following it. The manager of the store tried to convince them that it was not broken and there was no spaceship following the comet, but they would not change their mind. And, of course, I'm talking about the Heaven's Gate group. And the reason why I wanted to talk about Heaven's Gate is because there's a parallel that exists between what happens with Christianity from its beginning in history to what takes place during the modern time, and the same thing with Heaven's Gate. It's just that Heaven's Gate, when you look at their group, is just like a type of history of Christianity, and within just only a few years, so it's easy to understand. And in the same way that we look at Heaven's Gate and we go, how could you do such things? How could you have these ridiculous ideas concerning your faith and concerning the scientific claims that you're making about your faith? We should have the same type of reaction when we look at Christianity. The problem is that Christianity has 2,000 years of history dating from the time of Isa to the current time, and literally, who knows, hundreds of thousands of manuscripts that have been written from the time of Isa till now concerning theology and concerning history, concerning the heresies that they've called them and so forth. So it's very complex, and that's not even including the languages that are involved. Aramaic, Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and then those languages change depending on the translations that have taken place. And so when we're talking about the historical journey, I want to talk about a few problems that exist in this lecture. And that is two things. One, that you have a group of people who believe something about the religion. That it's true that when you're dealing with Christians, they believe that what their text is saying is historical. But there's a difference between saying something is historical and it's a historical reality. And what I mean by that is that just because you have something that's old, it doesn't mean that what you believe about it, because it's old, is also true. And that's what we're saying about the New Testament. That the fact that the New Testament is old doesn't mean that everything that Christians believe today about their faith is also historical. And the problem is like the Hellbach group, that they had historical reality surrounding them. And this is what I mean by historical reality. That is, that when you look at their text or at their religion, the things they say have something real about them. For instance, for Hellbach, there was a real comet. You could actually see it for yourself if you looked out with the naked eye, that you have real leaders that you can go to and ask these leaders, what is it that I believe? And they can say, well, you believe X, Y, and Z. And they have real places they can go to. Again, you have a center in Southern California by which you can go and be around other believers, and there's a big event coming. For the Hellbop group, it was the coming of the comet. Now, the fact that all that is true about it, or that there's a reality about this, doesn't mean that there's a real spaceship there. Now, in the same way with Christianity, though there was a historical Isa or a Jesus, that there were people called Pharisees and Sadducees, that there were wars with the Romans, and the Romans occupied this area, and that there was fighting at these times and wars, and that there were real Christians people, there was a real Paul, a real John, a real followers of Isa. The fact that all of that is true doesn't mean that the theology that's surrounding their faith is true. And the same thing can be said about their text. The fact that their text exists doesn't mean that they are understanding the text within the historical environment of Isa. And if you give me just a second, I'm going to move over, and I'm going to go over to the my second lecture and talk about this for a moment. And the first one, hold on just a moment. Is everybody seeing the historical environment before ESA? That's where we're at right now. Okay, well, I'm going to continue to talk, and then we'll try to fix it along the way. When we're talking about this problem, we're talking about if we're going to understand the historical reality of what's taking place, if we want to understand what really happened with during the time of ESA, you can't understand it. Hold on here. Hold on just a moment. I'm having problems here. Brother, it won't hit the follow with me. It says, just to the, I'm hitting that and it says browser following ended. Can everybody see the page now? Can you guys see the historical environment before ESA on the front of your page? Okay, hold on just a moment. Okay, brother, it's not letting me do it, so I'm just going to keep talking and then let's see. Okay, hold on just a moment. I think I got it. Okay, is everybody seeing it now? I should see it now. The historical environment before ESA? Okay, good. Now, the reason why I'm taking this a little slower is I want to make sure that, by the time we get to the next lecture next week, that everybody's on the same page. It's very important. So you can see this as hold on just a moment. It says browser following ended. Sal, can you let me know when you have it? Okay, good. Now what we're talking about here is here we have this problem concerning Christianity. And listen, Christians are not the only ones who have done a type of history concerning where they've come from. Muslims have been involved in it from the very beginning. We can go to some of the earliest texts during the rise of Islam, and we find Muslims trying to figure out this problem also. Because it's obvious that when you look into the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is making historical claims concerning about these people who live at this time. So at least we have the best way to understand this as a historical environment is by looking at Islam, and we find that these things have to be true. The problem is that so much has gone on in history that it's difficult to try to understand what's taken place during the time of ESA. Now my position is different than a lot of other persons who have done this type of discussion, because what I'm saying is we don't need to go to the texts themselves to try to find anything about ESA or about Jesus, who's the same person. But rather, if we want to understand ESA, we need to repaint the historical environment that existed not only during the time of ESA, but before him. Because the only way we can go back and say, well, I understand this period and what's taken place, is to understand the historical movement of Christianity. An analogy can be made this way. If you want to understand the history of America, like what happened that got us to this point right now, why are we having problems in the Middle East, for instance? You can't just understand it by reading yesterday's newspaper, or last week's newspaper, or the week before that, or last week, or one book from a year ago. I mean, this has been taking, this process of problems in the Middle East, for instance, has taken place over a long period of time. And unless you go back to writings, or you read books, or get information that talks about the evolution's problem in the beginning, you can't understand it. And the same thing is true when we talk about Isa and we talk about Christianity, that we have to go back to the beginning to understand it. Yes, we're on the historical environment before Isa for, yes, Chris. Now, what I talked about was this idea called cognitive dissonance. And that's this feeling that of extreme discomfort we feel inside of us when we have two ideas that we believe about ourselves or about other things around us that come into conflict with each other. For instance, I gave in the first lecture, I talked about smoking. If you believe yourself to be a logical person and a good person at heart, and you believe that you are a healthy, a living person, and then you're confronted by but you're a smoker, and you're confronted by the facts that smoking kills, that smoking isn't really a logical thing to do, you're going to die from it. You're going to get a disease from it. Your teeth are going to be stained. It's not socially acceptable. All of these things, that feeling that you have about yourself, or what you believe about yourself, that you're a good person, a logical person, that you're a healthy person, you're going to start to feel a little bit uncomfortable about this information. So you have to do something about it. One, you can decide that you're going to change what you believe about yourself. You can start saying to yourself, you know what, I'm really not that smart, and I'm really not that healthy, and therefore I smoke. Or you can justify it to yourself. You can say, oh, I do this, but the reason why I do it is because there's more benefit than harm. And not only that, but the statistics doesn't say everyone who smokes dies. Or you can decide that you're going to give up the habit and stick with what you believe about yourself as a healthy person. Now, the same thing is true about Christianity. Christianity arises at a time when you have a lot of people who understand at this time what the idea of like Messiah means. What does it mean to be a Jew? What are the laws of Jew? What is the Torah? What are the political problems of this time? Who are the Romans and where did they come from? All of these things during the time of Isa are known. So the minute that you have the beginning of Christianity and starting with Paul as opposed to the movement of Isa, what you have then is a group of people who are now confronted by the followers of Isa, as well as Jews who don't believe either way, who are pro-Roman, who are basically confronting these new, quote, Pauline Christians and saying, nothing you believe is based on anything that has happened in history. As a matter of fact, nothing around us testifies to what you're saying about this character, the Messiah, that you're talking about. Now you have cognitive dissonance. What are the Christians going to do? Because they believe that they're correct. That's a reality. There may be those among the Christian leaders who know that they're deceiving. But the reality is that the vast population, they're believers. They're following their leaders. So what do we have? We have this whole evolution of church history. What you have is a group of scholars who are beginning to talk about, if you scroll down a little bit, it says the Christian view of history, this idea of progressive revelation. What the Christians do is, in order to solve this problem of not being able to rely on anything historical for their beliefs, they begin to reinterpret history. And they say about history that there's been a progressive revelation in history. And if you look down, I have identified progressive revelation is the idea that the history of man is the history of God slowly revealing the plan of salvation through signs, symbols, and prophecies throughout the Old Testament. Let me explain what I mean by that. What I mean is that the Christians, they don't have a New Testament yet at this time that this is happening. And we'll talk about this later in a few weeks. They don't have any of that. All they have is what is today understood to be the Old Testament. And they're looking back on that and realizing that nothing they say about Isa can be verified or testified to by this book. So what they begin to say is, well, if we want to be able to understand Isa or Jesus, we must understand it by signs and symbols. For instance, if there is a verse that talks about a lamb, they say, well, that was symbolic for Jesus. And if it says something about there's a prophecy or a statement that says that there's going to be this person who's going to be suffering and he's going to be hung upon a tree, they say, oh, that's about Isa too. You see, God through history is beginning to reveal his plan. But there's a problem with this, is that the Christians are looking at the Old Testament as a progressive recording of history. And what I mean by that is they are believing that, like, Genesis comes, you know, historically first, and then the next book is Leviticus, and then Exodus, and Deuteronomy, and then Numbers, and all the other books of the Bible, that they come in order. So they look for these early prophecies, for instance, in the book of Genesis, and they say, see, here it is. That's the beginning. Here's the first prophecy, and we're moving towards the time of the completion of the Old Testament, and then Esau comes. There's a problem with that. Is those books compiled in their in the form they are today didn't exist like that during the time that they were written. Genesis was written during the same time as all these other books. Because you don't have we don't have the original writings of Musa. We don't have that. We only have copies of what other persons do after their captivity in Babylon. So they're not in chronological order, but the Christians see it this way. And the problem is that they're going to eventually be in power, and they're going to impose that view on the rest of the world and say, if you want to understand Esau, you must understand Esau in the form of progressive revelation. God was slowly revealing him throughout history. So that makes us right. Okay. Now, if you look down here, the next part, scroll down, it says historical prophecies are prophecy historicized. And let me explain what I mean. In the same way that we're talking about progressive revelation, the way Christians are looking at history, what they're doing also is taking, quote, prophecies from the Old Testament. And I'm telling you, these prophecies are ambiguous. And what I mean by ambiguous is that they're not clear. It could apply to a lot of things. Not only Esau, according to their views, it could apply to me. It could apply to my wife. It could apply to my child. It could apply to anybody. But they have taken them and said, these are prophecies. For instance, I gave you a couple here, and you, if you have a chance, it's not necessary, and you want to read them, you should read them. But read them not as history, like I just finished mentioning, but as rather prophecy historicized. And let me explain how they do that. What they do is they take the, quote, ambiguous prophecies of the Old Testament, and then they write a whole narrative around it. And what I mean is, when you have, for instance, Jesus in the New Testament, and it talks about him, he's in 40 days in the desert, and he's being taken up and tempted by the shaitan, by the devil, right? That may have historically happened, but in the sense of its text, that's not what the writers did. What the writers did is they were looking to somehow paint Esau in the exact same way that Moses was. So Moses and the children of Israel wandered for 40 years. Okay, well, let's take that, and I'm going to write here that Esau was in the desert for 40 days. That here in the Old Testament, you have somebody who's being tempted by the shaitan. I'm going to take that and put it over here, too, so that it looks like you're having prophecy fulfilled during the lifetime of Esau. But the reality is the writers themselves never knew Esau. They never saw these things. They're reconstructing the history of Jesus based on text in the Old Testament that they didn't see happen either way. They didn't see Jesus' life, and they didn't understand the text themselves when they read them. Now, there's a reason that there's some problems going on at this time. There's a real conflict that's taking place. And I talk about the rise of Hellenism in the area. Now, what's going to happen is in around about 300, if you scroll down a little bit, it says the rise of Hellenism, is that Alexander is going to come in, he's going to conquer Persia. He's going to conquer most of the area. Now, he's not able to control this area for a long time. But what he does when he conquers this is he brings in a Greek idea of everything. I mean, Greek philosophy, Greek poetry, Greek sexuality, which means, you know, homosexuality and bisexuality is okay. The Greek religions, which is polytheistic. He's going to bring in this area, and after he dies, his entire land, which stretches from the coastline all the way into India and down into Egypt, and even parts of, you know, Saudi Arabia and other parts of the Middle East, it's going to be broken up, and his generals who are going to take over after him are going to continue to spread this Hellenism. So what you're going to have in the middle is you're going to have the Jewish populations who have lived according to the Torah for centuries and centuries are now being pushed and squeezed right in the middle inside of Jerusalem and being forced to accept this new idea. So there's a revolt. There's a revolt against this. If you want to scroll down a little bit, I'm going to talk about down to where it says conflict. It says initially the Greeks leave the Jews to their religion and customs, but two things happen. Number one, the first thing that happens is that Greek becomes the language of education and success replacing Hebrew and Aramaic. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. What I mean is that before, where you have Aramaic and Hebrew, which is being spoken by the people, Hebrew in order so that they can understand the writings of their sacred texts, of their books, the Torah, in the same way that Muslims are still learning Arabic in order to understand the Quran in its completeness, as well as the teachings of the Messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Jews are doing that also, but in order for them to be successful, either politically, economically, you know, to be able to be educated persons, to have their children to be successful, they give up sending their kids to the Hebrew schools, and they start sending them to the Greek schools so that they can learn the language of success, Greek. But what happens, not overnight, but in a period of time, is that the Jews have now a larger population of powerful Hellenized Jews, meaning that they have learned to speak Greek, they have been influenced by Greek thought, the philosophy, the religions, the art, everything has been now has influenced the Jews who have strayed away from the original teachings. And now you have a population of those who are trying to live correctly by the rules of the Old Testament, now in competition with these Hellenized Jews who now are powerful because they've learned this language. Now they are the merchants. They are the political leaders this time. They are the persons who are exercising extreme amount of power, while the persons who have rejected that and decided to stick with their own customs are now the persecuted poor. They have nothing. And there is a gulf between the Hebrews who have decided to stay on the correct path and the Hellenized Jews. They can't compete anymore. And the reason why they can't compete is because unless you compromise and give up your religion, unless you compromise and give up your practice, your social practices, you can't compete anymore. You can't. You've got to give it up all. It's like, for instance, you have today a modern manifestation of this where you have the Arab populations who are sending their kids other places, their children other places to get education. They want to teach them English. They want to make sure that they become, you know, great scientists. They want to become doctors and lawyers and engineers and so forth. And they've given up the basis by which the Islamic nation has become great. And that is that Islam has been been at the root of everything that Muslims have done in the beginning. But that's slowly changing. And this takes place also with the Jews. It happens so badly with these people that in 169, if you scroll down, it says 169 BCE, Antiochus eliminates the high priesthood. And we talked about this. Sal was talking earlier about the priest. There's a misunderstanding about priests this time because the Jewish priest, at least, the way they operated, wasn't just as somebody who gave law, because they didn't. Law was already given. They operate simultaneously as the imam or the leader of their Abu Ismail, I lost the document. Okay, hold on. Let me try it one more time. Okay, do you have it now, brother? Okay, I'm not sure how to get it back on. Okay, hold on, brother. I'll see if I can work on it while I'm talking. Well, in 169, what happens is Antiochus eliminates the leader of the Jewish people this time, who that has been instilled and emplaced over the religion for as long as we can remember. Now, what happens is the Greeks make the Jews worship the Greek idols and eat pork sacrifices in order to honor in the idols' honor. And the reason why the Greeks did this is because they wanted to test the loyalty of these Jews who are causing problems, because they're starting to revolt. They're starting to be upset by what they by what's happening around them. Their entire way of life is crumbling. You have the largest population of it who don't want to worship with piety. You're moving away from that. Now the Greeks decide, including the Jews, have decided that they're going to test the rest of these Jews to make sure they're not going to revolt. Now what they do is the Greeks begin to kill anyone who circumcises his child and also the child. So what happens? The Jews revolt. In 168 to 165, the Jews lead a revolt. But why? Why do they lead a revolt? Because you have a population who believes that there is no separation between religion and the rule of a society. They go hand in hand. That, unlike the Greeks who believe that at the head of a society isn't God, that the head of the society is the king or the ruler. He is God manifest. I mean, we can see that clearly when we see, for instance, Caesars who become living deities. Well, of course, the Jews at this time, specifically called the Hasidim, not to be confused with the modern Hasidim, the Pietists, they reject this. They say, you can't do that. So they run into the mountains, and they decide that they're going to revolt against these Hellenized Jews as well as their Greek leaders. But the problem is they are sticklers for law. And what I mean by that is they interpret everything literally. They do not see any type of figurative understanding about anything. So what they do is they decide they're not going to fight on the Sabbath. They're not going to fight on Saturday. And all the Greeks do is they just come right in and they slaughter them, you know, on Saturday because these Jews aren't going to fight. Well, this isn't the case for another person who's going to rise up, Judah Maccabee. This is important to understand because Judah Maccabee is going to be the legacy by which we're going to see Esau and the followers of Esau take up the banner after him. Judah Maccabee, called the Hammer, takes over these followers, and these followers are called the Maccabees, the Hammers. And they make a really bad choice by aligning themselves with Rome in order to overthrow Greek influence and Greek leadership, and they go to war. And they do one heck of a job because the Greeks are pushed into position where they must make peace in 165, but Judah Maccabee isn't okay with that. He continues to die. He continues to fight until he's killed in order to have an independent state that has, we'll say, Allah at the head of the state. Now, what we talked about after this period, and unfortunately I don't know if I have that listed, but give me just a moment, and I'm going to try to go back and post that up here. Just a moment. Well, I guess I was right about that. Those are not up here yet. And that's okay because I have them in front of me right now. And you'll have to listen along as I'm talking. Now, what we talked about last week is how do we find Esau? How do we find him in all this mess? Well, I've said one thing is that as we're looking through history, if we begin to try to understand the social environment, and what I mean by social environment is that everything that's going around the time of Esau, that if you start to listen to that and look at it, you don't find what the Christians have misconstrued about their own history. You don't find a Messiah who is claiming to be God. You don't have a Messiah who's claiming he's going to die and save the rest of humanity as long as you believe. You don't have that. What you have instead is you have a Messiah who's very Jewish. Now again, don't confuse when I talk about the Jews of this time with the Jews that exist today. The vast majority of Jews today are so close to the line of atheism, if not inside of atheism, that you can't compare them with these group of people. These group of people who lived during the time of Esau were not only willing to give their entire lives to the pursuit of holiness and piety and to making the name of Allah the highest in their land, but also to literally giving their lives in order to make sure that happens. And they do that. A prime example of that is, like I said before, Judah Maccabee. Judah Maccabee, who continues to fight because it's not enough just to be at peace with the Greeks. He wants that entire influence gone from the people. And my real feeling is that these people at this time are in fact sincere. They're sincere about their desire to see this happen for them. The unfortunate part is that when Muslims begin to talk about, I'd say this generally, when Muslims begin to talk about the Jews during this time, they forget that at one time there was a population of Jews who were on the straight path. And we have to remember that. Now, the last time we talked about finding Esau, and I called it finding Esau, the Messiah, a method. And what I mean by finding him as a method is that we can't just go and look at the New Testament to find him. And we explained that already. And the reason why you can't do that is because there's too much mess in there. It's like trying to find something to eat out of a trash can. I mean, you could do that. I mean, you could go over to a trash can and try to find something to eat, and it may be edible. But the alternative is to find something more wholesome. The alternative is to find something that gets clean, to find its origin. If you find a hamburger inside the trash can, you can go to a hamburger stand and find yourself a hamburger rather than dealing with it in a trash can. And that's what I mean by a method, kind of. What I mean by method is that if we use all of these pieces of how we understand both the problem of finding ESA and at the same time of understanding that there is a solution. The solution, of course, is not to get involved with what other Muslims, Allahu Alam, with good intentions, have got involved with this. And that is that they begin to look at the New Testament as some form of partially true Injil. Now, last time I said, you know, quickly that that's not true, that the New Testament has absolutely nothing to do with the Injil. There does seem to be some really interesting things that seem to point that there was one. There was an original document. But even the modern discoveries that we have found don't show us a modern, our modern discoveries do not show us a document that we can say for sure, here is the book of ESA. Well, the first thing I said last week was this. Forget about what you've heard about Christianity from anybody else up until this time. If their ideas, no matter how grand, do not match up with the environment of this time, it is not authentic. It is purely literary interpretation and conjecture. Conjecture, of course, meaning guessing. They're guessing about it. And it's not factual analysis. And what I'm saying is this, is that it is not my intention to try to give my own opinion about what I believe this text says about this text in the sense of contradictions, or I'm going to interpret some old Jewish text to say, here for sure is a prophecy about the coming of the messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which I know that a number of brothers have done that. Or doing the opposite of being a little more fast talker and, you know, about this by saying, well, this seems to point to the messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But I'm not going to say yes or no. You read it for yourself. But by the way, buy my book, you know, for $20, where I've spent 500 pages talking about this particular conjecture of mine. I don't believe that we should do that either. I believe that, like any other science, you can look at history and you can find out quite a bit. I am not saying that we can know everything about Isa or about its time. What I'm saying is that there's quite a bit that we can understand. But we must understand first that there are three things that are causing a problem with this, this pursuit. One is literature and conjecture. And I just pointed that out a minute ago. And what I mean by literature and conjecture is that what many Muslims are doing, and Christians have done it for 2,000 years, they don't know how to do anything else but to be involved in conjecture. But what Muslims are doing is, in the same way that you would take a literature class and you're asked to read a novel, I used the example last week of Frankenstein. You read Frankenstein and you can have any type of interpretation about that you want. You can have a feminist interpretation. You can have a communist interpretation. You can have some type of nihilist Nietzsche interpretation. You can start looking for themes inside of it about man versus nature and a whole bunch of things. And you can write, I mean, hundreds of pages on it. People have. People write their dissertation on Mary Shelley's book, Frankenstein. They do this. But it doesn't mean that what's happening inside that book is a historical reality. It doesn't mean that. We just finished talking about this. Just because there is a monster in that text doesn't mean that the monster was a real person. And it doesn't mean that because Shelley has written about a monster that we understand exactly what that means, even though we may have a good idea about what she means by monster. On the other end, though, looking at a piece of literature like the New Testament, there is something we can do that helps us. In the same way that, like I said last week, we can look at Mary Shelley's life. For instance, we know that Mary Shelley's mother died very young. Shelley didn't really know her. That Shelley used to go to the grave and talk to her mother and desire for her to come back. We can start getting a little bit into the psychology of Mary Shelley and get a pretty good idea about what she was doing. Now, if we take that into account, as well as the historical environment she comes from, for instance, during the time that she wrote this, how were women treated? How did society view women? How did society view science and technology? How did they view their natural world? We can begin to make a pretty good reconstruction of this time period and still not be necessarily involved in a type of conjecture. Other persons do that. We're not going to do that. there is something we can say about this, and I want to restate it because it's important. And that is that it is possible, though, for us to say, no, this is not true about the New Testament or about Christianity. And I gave an example. Jesus did not predict Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in the New Testament. It didn't happen. I don't care how many books have been written about it. It didn't happen. What you have is fast talkers and swindlers, you know, Muslims who are involved in conjecture, who are involved in saying things like, well, Jesus spoke Aramaic, and hypothetically, if you take an Aramaic word and translate it into the Hebrew, which in turn, the Hebrew got translated into the Greek, and the Greek into English, we get something that says, Ahmed. Well, I mean, that's really interesting. The problem is, we don't have any Aramaic text. We don't have any Hebrew text. So what you're doing is purely guessing, with no basis. This is not even the type of work that many Muslims have done. Isn't even, you can't even say it's historical, because they're not basing their opinions by anything except for the English text, or at most the Greek text, which we don't have the Hebrew or the Aramaic supposedly it came from. It would be the same thing if I took the Quran and I have it in English. Let's say I have some Westerner's, you know, translation or interpretation, I should say, of the Quran. And then I say, well, let me go back and let me try to put this into Arabic. But I don't know Arabic. And I look at it and I go, what does this word I hear, qul huwa Allahu ahad, what does this mean if I try to find words for this from English and put it back into Arabic? Now, I don't speak Arabic, but I have enough common sense to know that by the time I finish with that ayah, I've destroyed it. And worse so if I say, I have a Spanish text. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this Spanish text, which was translated from an English, and I'm going to take the, and then I'm going to go further and try to get that English back in the Aramaic. Oh, I got a question. Let's see. Salem says, exactly. You know, Salem makes a good point about when the Christians are involved in looking at the Quran and trying to find English equivalents. And the problem is the Quran doesn't say that. What you have is a man who's done one of two things, interpreted badly or intentionally interpreted it badly, and then you have people who have bad intentions going back and taking advantage of that and causing fitna. But that's what's taking place inside of Christianity. Now, I can say, yes, things are true. For example, the New Testament was not the Injil. Now, the reason why we know it's not the Injil or the writings of Jesus is because we know the historical environment of this time. We know enough about it. We know enough about the people who are writing at this time to be able to make that claim and to do it without being bashful about it. We can also say something else that's very honest. I don't know. There isn't enough evidence. For instance, there are verses inside of the Quran that talk about the early parts of Isa's life and the early parts of the life of Mary, the mother of Isa. Well, I can find texts that say things about that, but I don't know everything yet. Maybe I won't. Maybe that's for some other Muslim to come along 3 or 4 generations later. They're going to have something where they can reconstruct all that. I can't do that yet, but I can make some guesses about it, but I don't even think that's going too far. Hold on, it says, the brother wrote, not trying to digress, could you give a slight example of where Christians have made claims of the Trinity? I've never heard that before. Brother, you know what we'll do is after we finish this lecture, because I'm going to start on the new material in a minute, we do questions, we'll talk with the brother Salim about that, because he's going to have a better understanding of both Quran and Arabic than I have, you know, inshallah. So we talked about our purpose. What do we know so far? Everything that we've said so far. First of all, that Judah has a history of war against Hellenism. And what I mean by that is that during the time of Jesus and before him, there is nothing but warfare taking place at this time. It's nonstop, because they're struggling against Hellenization. There are very few social classes. And what I mean by that is you basically have rulers, you have merchants, and you have the poor. and the poor predominantly are the people who are on the correct path. Now, I'm not the only one who's pointing out there are problems with Christians, what Christians are saying. In fact, the Jews have been doing that from day one. The Jews have been involved in this, in saying, you don't know what you're talking about. The problem is that Christianity very early becomes a political power. And what they do is, they put laws against the Jews. As a matter of fact, if we get to it, well, we will get to it, but not in this lecture, the Christians are going to put laws against the Jews arguing with new Christians, or arguing with Christians at all. Eventually, they're going to make it the penalty of death. You can't talk about Hebrew. You can't talk about Aramaic. You're going to be put in jail. You're going to be killed for that. There's a reason. It's not based on anything. Now, last week, we talked about the interpretation of the Messiah prophecies. Just a moment. And I said there's a number of places so we can understand the Messiah. It's important to us also, because I believe that when we finish talking about the Messiah, we end up with something that is very Islamic. Well, it should be, because there's a continuation of messengers, you know, from Adam on, who have the same message. It's people who mess up this understanding. That even during this time, you have a number of people who are talking about Messiahs. You have the Romans who are talking about it. The Romans, you have the Hellenized Jews, and you have those who are going to be killed in this battle to remove this Hellenized version of society. They're going to talk about it also. And what we come out with is that nothing we find in history, nothing comes with this idea that the Messiah during this time has anything to do with the God-man, or the God-man coming so that when he dies, we can eat his body and drink his blood symbolically, and we somehow get salvation. None of that is based on history. None of that has any history. There is no idea of the passive Messiah who dies for his spiritual kingdom. In reality, what you have at this time is the expectation that a military Messiah is going to come. A Messiah who's going to come, who's going to prepare the people for warfare. For what? To overthrow the perversion of their society. There's an injustice. You have poor people. How does that take place with the structure of the laws of Allah in a society? How does that happen? Well, obviously, it doesn't happen by the people sticking to the correct path. What happens is you have a whole bunch of Jews who have decided that they're going to compromise with the Hellenized world, and they're going to subject their own people. It's an ugly time. Now, the problem that I have with this, and I think you should too, is that when we're starting to talk about Isa from the point of view of Christianity, what we end up with is not the Isa we know. We end up with an Isa who is a coward, who won't take a stand, who's in the midst of suffering of his people. He's watching, according to the Christian point of view, thousands of people being crucified. He's watching his own people lay down their life. He's watching the Romans coming in. They kill children. They kill women. They are the most hideous people who have lived at this time. And what do you have according to Christianity? This passive Isa who sits on mountains and won't take a side and basically says, why can't we all get along? Astaghfirullah. What a shame. What a shame. The reality is that's not what happened. The reality is that the Romans came in and they have to bring in legions to calm a problem that takes place this time. The Jews are revolting. Do they revolt because you have this population who's sitting around singing Kumbaya with their legs crossed, swinging back and forth, playing guitars? No, they're in war. I mean, it's like saying that during the time of the messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, would we have a different point of view of the messenger? And I know this is purely hypothetical. If he didn't act the way he did to protect his people, to protect the Muslims, if the Muslims didn't protect themselves, would we have the same view of them? If they sat around and allowed themselves to be killed, their daughters and their wives to be taken as slaves, would we have the same view? I mean, don't we say at least that that it's innate within man, that there is a sense of nobility about a man who stands up for ideas of justice and integrity? But for some reason, the Christians, when they talk about history, they don't see that. They don't see that the idea that they have imposed about this passive Isa is the idea of a coward who is the best that God can give mankind. Astaghfirullah, what a shame. So this is my passion. My passion is to rescue this idea, because when we look at Islam, we find an Isa who is valiant, who is courageous, whose everything was Allah. His followers, whose everything was Allah. And they proved it by giving their lives for it, even while being betrayed. Now, I want to clear up a few things that if there were Christians who were listening to this, would have some arguments about what I'm saying. And this is where I'm going to get to a very short point of my new lecture. And that is that the Christians' understanding of Messiah, which we've discussed as progressive revelation, and the words that are used to describe Isa in the New Testament, has led them astray. Now, I mean two things by that. That unless they begin to see that history can be tested outside of the Old Testament, of the writings of the Jews. And number two, understand that the words that they're using to describe Isa, words like Messiah, Prophet, Son of David, Lord, Son of God, all of those which are in the New Testament, we can't deny that. If a Muslim is involved in trying to disprove that those are in there, they're involved in something that is absolutely ridiculous, because those things are actually there. Now, what I mean by the words that are there is that Christians use these words. But when they use these words, they use them outside of their linguistic meaning. It's, for instance, if I was quoting the Quran and then started to talk about Allah as concerning Arabic, the Quran, and I begin to say things about Allah that don't line up with what Islam says, for instance, I begin to talk about a polytheistic idea of Allah, or I begin to talk about Allah as having some type of personal relationship with me in the sense because he's inside of me, that somehow Allah has, you know, come inside of my spirit and now I am Allah-like or something like this. That is talking about Allah outside of the linguistic meaning we understand about Allah. It's definition. The Christians have done the same thing. They use words like Messiah and then apply the idea of divinity to it. We talked about this. It's not possible. Because those ideas don't exist. They don't happen until after Isa. Now here's another one you're going to hear. One of them is the Son of Man. Christians love quoting this because, again, they have historicized prophecy. And one of them, or some of these prophecies, are concerning the Son of Man who's going to come and rule the earth. Well, the problem with Son of Man is looking at Hebrew and Aramaic. Son of Man is seen as two things in these languages. One as a noun, and the other is a circumlocution. And let me explain these, because we're talking about grammar here, in parts of speech. If I said of myself, one never knows what one might do, who am I talking about? I'm talking about me. If I said, for instance, I might go over here, or you might go over there, I'm still using the same types of parts of speech. I'm still addressing you and using it like a noun. You're going over there. You're going over here. You're a person. I'm talking to you. Now, at this period of time, this is the way the word Son of Man is being used. Son of Man is the same during this time period as me saying, I am going to go do this. Or, he is going to do this. Did you see the Son of Man doing such and such? If there's nobody else around, and I'm obviously pointing about myself, I'm talking about me. But I could also be talking about somebody else. I could be looking at, say, Solomon saying, did you see the Son of Man teaching today? I'm not giving him any divinity. I'm addressing him as a human being. But again, Christians have taken that in English and have applied their own definition to it. But it has nothing to do with history. The other thing is the idea of the prophet. That by calling Isa a prophet from the Christian's point of view, that somehow has some type of divine meaning. But again, we're looking at the historical environment of Isa. Forget whether or not there's historic realities. For instance, that there was an Isa and people used the term Son of Man or prophet. Those things are both true. But we're talking about the reality of how they're used. Son of Man isn't used to designate a Messiah or a human being with divine qualities, and neither is prophet. The Jews would have killed, if Isa would have said this of himself, that prophet means the same as some type of divine attribute or godlike attribute, they also, they would have stoned him. They would have killed him if he said such a thing. It's ridiculous. Now, the most difficult ones for Muslims to deal with is the idea of Lord. This is one of them. Because it does say that in the New Testament. The problem with saying that in the New Testament, though, again, linguistic problem. The word Lord, to give a notion of divinity, doesn't take place inside during the time of Isa. It doesn't come around until afterwards. For instance, it may be possible someday that the calling somebody the president is going to be seen as a divine attribute. Who knows if that's going to happen or not? But the reality is, if we're looking at this time period that we live in, if I use the word president, either I do it satirically or I do it literally, which means I'm talking to George W. or I'm talking to somebody who's a leader of some club or the leader of some organization, and that person's the real president, well, he's a president. It's a position. Or I could be saying it to be humorous, like I could call somebody the president of the disbelievers. Well, it's not a real presidency of the disbelievers, of course, though we'd like to nominate a number of people for that. But the reality is that there is a linguistic, historical meaning for that. Same thing with Lord. And during this period of time, it is not used to describe divinity in a human in either Aramaic or Hebrew. Not until after Isa does it start to be used that way. Lord is only used in Jesus' Aramaic to describe a king or a ruler, not a divinity, which makes perfect sense if you have somebody who is using the word in the Aramaic word for Lord to address Isa. That makes sense. He was the Messiah. The Messiah was coming to lead a physical kingdom. He would be the equivalent to the Khalifa. Of course. Now, the other term is Messiah. We've talked about this extensively. And there is nothing in history that shows that the Messiah has ever, in Jewish thought, been equated with divinity. Now, I know what Christians do a number of times, and that is that when they talk about the Messiah, they do the same thing I've been talking to you about before, which is this idea of progressive revelation, where they look for the most ambiguous things so they can say, see, if you read this passage about this other Messiah, there seems to be something symbolically here that points to the fact that Messiah has something symbolically related to divinity, and therefore we should interpret it that way literally. Ridiculous. Now, the last one is the idea of Son of God. In Hebrew, and during the history, the time of Isa, the Son of God did not have the connotations that it has today. Now, no one needs to be a genius who's a Muslim to figure that out. We know that from Islam, that there's no such thing as the literal Son of Allah. Allah tells us clearly in the Quran. But let's see what the Jews thought at this time. Now, I have something really interesting here. One is what they called post-biblical Judaism. Post-biblical Judaism, which means after the fact that the Old Testament is written, what did the Jews say? Well, let's put it this way. Whereas every Jew was called Son of God, the title came to be given preferably to the just man, and in a very special sense, to the most righteous of all just men, the Messiah, Son of David. What this means is that the Jews refer to themselves as the sons of God. And I'm going to explain what that means in a minute. But later on, during Jewish thinking, it became to designate the idea of the Messiah would be called that. And there's a reason why. Because the texts that are being used to talk about this in the Old Testament, which are most of these are no longer in the Bible for good reason. They've removed these texts. You can't have them in there because it contradicts this idea. The Christian idea, that is the idea of the just man. This is what it says. And here's a verse, and this is in Ecclesiasticus. It's not in the Old Testament anymore. This is what it says. Be a father to the fatherless, and as a husband to widows, and God shall call you son, and shall have mercy on you, and deliver you from the pit. Now, when we read this in English, we can get a distorted meaning. But in the historical time, what was being talked about in the text is that if you obey the laws that Allah has given, that you're obeying Allah symbolically. Here is a real symbolism in the Old Testament, a real one, that if you do that, you are acting towards Allah the way an obedient son acts towards his father, in the sense that when a father asks his son to do something, that son does it. And then the best type of son does it because he desires to please his father. It's symbolic. That is a real symbolism. And there's a reason why we know that, because the Jews understood it that way. Here's one, for instance, about a bunch of Jews who want to go after a righteous man, a pious man. It says this: "Let us test the truth of his words. Let us see what will happen to him in the end. For if the just man is God's son," remember symbolically, "God will stretch out a hand to him and save him from the clutches of his enemy." Now that's interesting, because even the people who are after these righteous men, or who don't believe him, even they say, if he really was on the correct path, and he's one of the most pious, he is one of the people who practice his religion with the utmost taqwa. And of course, the history of Islam, when we look at the hadith of the Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and we look at the Quran, it's filled with these ideas about the man who is broken in the presence of Allah and stands there in absolute submission. It is the basis of our faith. It's submission. And this is what this is talking about, submission. And that when you submit, the utmost submitting is when you have come towards the laws of Allah and towards Allah as an obedient son is towards his father. And then you get this terminology placed on you. That is God's son. Now, this is interesting, because if you ask even the most Hellenized Jews, the Jews who hate traditional Judaism, there's something really interesting about this, and that is because even somebody like Philo, who's reading this, he says, commentating on Deuteronomy, it says, "If you obey the voice of the Lord, keeping all his commandments and doing what is right in the sight of the Lord your God, you are sons of God." Philo, who we talked about this in a few lectures, I think last lecture, this is what he says what it means. Here's a Hellenized Jew. He says, "The promise of mine is confirmed by the law, where it says that they who do what is pleasing to nature and what is good are sons of God," symbolically. So even you have the most Hellenized Jew who would love to adopt Greek ideas inside of the religion, understand that son of God did not mean literally the offspring, but rather it had to do with somebody who was absolutely submitted to the will of Allah, and he does it joyfully. He does it as a person who loves his father. Now, the reason why all this is important is because when we start talking about, starting next week and the week after, about Isa and his movement specifically, you have to remember something with everything that is said. And that is that when we're viewing the history of Christianity, we're viewing two histories. We're viewing a history of a population who really did exist. Because remember, Christians are talking about history. They are talking about historical characters. We talked about this. They are talking about a real Jesus, a real Jerusalem, a real Roman Empire, real Pharisees and Sadducees, real events. But the reality is, they're talking about events that had nothing to do with them. They're reflecting, and embarrassingly so, on a group of people who really were on the straight path, and that was the followers of Isa. So we begin to understand that all of the New Testament, all of the Christian writings, have been written in order to cover up the Christians' own humiliation. Their own humiliation. Let me give you an example. let's say hypothetically, and this is just a hypothetical question, analogy, that the Americans, hypothetically, were persecuting Islam in a Muslim country, hypothetically, again. And they said you couldn't practice the religion. And they begin to go and do what the Greeks did, which is go door to door and make you pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And if you don't do so, they were going to throw you into jail because obviously you're in a faction of dissidents. And therefore, you need to be arrested and to be persecuted. It is likely that a number of Muslims, and some of them already have, would begin to come up with the most outlandish things about Islam. They begin to say all kinds of Islam to make it as compatible as possible with whoever is ruling that country at that time. You would even have those who are, quote, called alims, or imams, who are doing the same thing, who are changing the religion so they can avoid persecution. It's happened throughout our entire history, and it happened during the history of Christianity. This is what the New Testament is. They are writings to try to reinterpret Isa because they're ashamed of him, the Christians are. Because this Isa that they have is an Isa who loves Rome. This is the Isa who says, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and give unto God's what is God's. How interesting and profound is that? Especially, again, when you have an Isa who is sitting and watching his own people be massacred. Now let's say that that isn't true. Where would we get information about that? Where would we get an information that would tell us the truth of what happens, that would rescue the noble name of Isa from the clutches of Christian compromise? And I mean that literally. When I mean compromise, I mean a type of compromise that is unparalleled in history. We're talking about the absolute rejection of their prophet. The absolute rejection. We're talking about a group of Jews who not only reject their prophet, they reject their entire religion. They destroy it. Destroy it. And end up with something that is purely Hellenized, which is purely Roman, and they also get involved in this. It's not only the Christians who do this, it is the Jews embarrassed by their Messiah. Embarrassed by it. So they begin to pump out and write books and say, no. The true history of Judaism begins in some type of Hellenized milieu where we also have a philosophy. We also have this rabbinical priesthood. They also begin to reinvent these, quote, type of hadith called the oral traditions that go back to the time of Musa to try to remove the history of their own struggle. To try to forget about those who fought for their religion, who fought for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make his name the highest in the land. If it hadn't been for Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and Allah coming and giving us Quran and giving us the correct teaching, correct understanding, it would have been lost forever. And what a slap in the face for the Christians and the Jews who worked for almost a century trying to hide it, for Allah to move the dust. And to give us truth, and to show us that he's not only capable of giving us direction in our lives and for our society, but he is the most correct in giving us an understanding of as what has taken place with his prophets before the coming of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now next week we're going to start on a movement called the Nazarites, the Nasara. And what's important about the Nazarites is that they are part of the movement of Isa. In short, the Nazarites are those who have dedicated themselves from birth to piety and to the purity of the religion. And it began to come around during the time of Hellenization, a group of people who said they wouldn't compromise at all. Isa, Yahya, John the Baptist, and the followers of Isa are all on this path. Next week we're going to start talking about it, inshallah. It's very important that if you didn't understand anything that I've said so far, I'm going to release the mic in just a moment, inshallah, and we'll talk about this a little bit, inshallah. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum.